Good old-fashioned smog, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Britain and France want to phase out gasoline and diesel vehicles. And it's not just because of climate change.
This was really about old-fashioned smog. We call them tailpipe emissions here in the U.S. from cars that make people sick.
Also, more electric cars on the road sounds good, but
people are reluctant to buy an electric car until they see those charging stations out there.
Plus, we remember Harvard's Hidden Figures. They were trailblazing astronomers at a time when women had no place in science.
If you were a more technically inclined, nerdy little nerd bird girl, not having many people to look up to or examples to look at to see yourself in, it's hard.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. Another day of political intrigue and maneuvering in Washington. We're actually going to take a break and not go there today. We will go to Turkey, Syria, and Pakistan, and outer space. But we're going to start with something that's close to home for just about all of us, and that's cars. Specifically, the end of cars that run on petroleum, an end that may now be in sight. Maybe even by 2050. The latest strong signal of the turn away from the internal combustion engine toward cleaner electric motors comes this week from the UK. That's where the government has announced that it will ban the sale of new gas and diesel cars by the year 2040. The World's environment editor Peter Thompson is in the studio with me. So give us the details of this announcement, Peter.
Well, Marco, it comes on the heels of a similar announcement made by France just a couple of weeks ago, actually, and also a number of smaller countries and large cities around the world, Paris, Athens, Mexico City. The UK's environment minister, Michael Gove, made the call yesterday. Specifically, the ban is on cars that run only on petroleum, diesel, gasoline. That means over the next couple of decades, they're going to speed up the transition to hybrid vehicles that also have an electric engine built in, and also to battery-powered cars, of course. And with that transition, there'll have to be a lot of other big changes, things like creating thousands of charging stations around the country, but also probably technological breakthroughs that are going to improve the distance that a car can go on a charge.
So what was behind this move by the UK? I mean, is this mostly about climate change and trying to cut carbon pollution?
Actually, I mean, the carbon and climate issue is certainly going on in the background here, but this was really about old-fashioned smog. We call them tailpipe emissions here in the U.S. from cars that make people sick.
Yeah.
It's actually still a very big problem in a lot of big European cities, as it is in much of the world, and the governments there have been under a lot of pressure to solve it. Surprisingly, here, perhaps to us in the U.S., they were putting a lot of their faith in what was called clean diesel, things like the Volkswagen cars that we've been hearing a lot about recently. They promised much lower emissions than gasoline cars. But of course, the VW scandal of the last couple of years has really just about killed that dream. You remember VW got caught cheating on their diesel engines to make them look like they were cleaner than they really are. So without those clean diesel engines, a lot of governments and even car companies are now trying to make a quick pivot toward electricity.
Yeah, but as you've already suggested, that transition is going to be bumpy at best.
Yeah, and we've actually got someone here in our newsroom who's gotten caught right in the middle of that, and we've got him here too, and it's our own Jason Margolis.
Yes, thank you. I was caught in the middle. So I had a clean diesel, a Volkswagen Golf, a TDI. I loved it. It got 44 miles per gallon, but then it got recalled because it was emitting too many pollutants, as you say, too many tailpipe emissions. And so Volkswagen gave me about $7,000 back off of a $20,000 car. I bought it used. So I chose to take the money.
And what'd you do with it?
I bought another Volkswagen. And so I was looking to buy an electric car, the e-Golf. And ultimately, I decided not to do it. And the reason why I didn't was two reasons: how far you could go on a charge and the ability to charge. So for the e-Golf right now, you can go about 83 miles to the charge.
That's the range.
And I thought that was fine for commuting back and forth to work. But I was a little concerned, like, you can't really do much else beyond that. And the second issue was, where do you charge it? The charging cable is 20 feet. And I have an outside power adapter that was 22 feet from as close as I could get the car. So I was 2 feet shy of making it happen. But, the bigger problem was I just didn't know where to charge it. There's nowhere to charge it at my work. I was concerned.
Yeah. Well, these are some of the challenges that we're going to talk about next. The World's Jason Margolis here along with our environment editor, Peter Thompson. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Okay, so concerns about range and charging infrastructure, those are just some of the big challenges ahead as the world tries to move away from the internal combustion engine. So let's turn now to someone who's been wrestling with these and other challenges for years. Daniel Sperling runs the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis, and we're reaching him today on vacation in the wilds of Connecticut. Daniel, did you get to your vacation spot by electric car by any chance?
No, I wish. These rental car places aren't with the program yet.
Right. Okay.
But I am using my zero emission bicycle around Connecticut here.
Good man. All right. So let's talk about electric cars. I think probably the biggest concern for most drivers, as we just heard from Jason Margolis, is range. So how are the car companies trying to deal with this?
They have basically two strategies. One is you put more batteries in the vehicle so you can go further. That, of course, costs more. The other option is to use plug-in hybrids, which means that the batteries will give you maybe 40 miles or so of range, and then it switches to gasoline or it could be diesel. And so in that way, you have essentially same range or longer. With a pure battery car, you do have the range issue. But most trips, most people don't travel more than 30 or 40 miles in a day. So in fact, even just charging once a day at home or locally really gives you essentially zero emission travel.
As to your first point, though, I mean, there is a trade-off between getting more battery in a car and the space you have to fit your family and your stuff in, right?
Right. And there's a cost. And in fact, that's probably the more important factor. The cost of these vehicles have to come down and be competitive. But I think we're going to see steady reduction in battery costs.
So the second big challenge is the charging stations or the lack of them. How quickly can things change on the charging front?
Well, they can change pretty quickly because the reality is most people are going to be charging, number one, at home. The second place is at workplace. So the next campaign is to get employers to put in chargers. And public charging is really the third priority. They're important still, probably more for psychological reasons, and that is people are reluctant to buy an electric car until they see those charging stations out there.
There's another big concern that I've always wondered about, the environmental impact of the electricity itself, because right now most of the world's electricity is still produced by burning fossil fuels. So at least when it comes to carbon dioxide pollution and climate change, moving from gas and diesel to electric, it would just shift the emissions from one source to another, right? So is it realistic we can shift to renewable energy quickly enough to meet the demand that all of these electric cars could end up by creating?
I think you need to look at this strategically. And we have to count on the electricity people continuing to use renewable energy and decarbonizing the electricity system at the same time as the vehicle sector starts making more electric vehicles. And the reality is we have quite a few years before we get to a large number of electric vehicles on the road.
So as we've been speaking, there's an assumption that the replacement for fossil fuel cars will be ones that run on batteries. Is that correct? Or are there other technologies that we're missing here?
There's one other important one, and that is hydrogen gas. And they would be used in electric vehicle, but a different kind of electric vehicle, one that had a fuel cell in it. So it's still in fact, I own a hydrogen fuel cell car myself. I get about 300 miles of range before I have to refuel it.
And the emissions?
So, emissions zero. Zero emissions. So we'll probably see, we're definitely going to see a mix of hydrogen and battery vehicles.
Daniel Sperling of the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis. Thanks very much for doing Electric Cars 101 for us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
In a courtroom in Istanbul, freedom of the press is literally on trial. This week, 17 journalists and executives from Turkey's leading and possibly only remaining independent newspaper face charges that they aided terrorist organizations. It's part of the government's broad sweep of arrests after last summer's attempted coup. The accused work for Cumhuriyet, a secular newspaper founded back in 1924. Most of the accused have been in jail for 9 months. They include the paper's editor-in-chief, an investigative reporter, a columnist, and a political cartoonist. Selen Girit is a reporter with the BBC and joins us from Istanbul. So what's the scene been like at the courthouse this week, Selen?
The scene has been very emotional at times and very tense too. The journalists who were in the dock were denying all the accusations against them, including aiding a terrorist organization. They were saying what they have done up until now has been only journalism. And this case was actually trying to prevent them from doing their job, that this was actually a politically motivated case and denying all the charges against them.
Yeah, many of the defendants are reading pretty powerful statements to the court. I wonder if you can just give us a few examples of what they're saying.
Yes, there have been many very strong statements in the court. For instance, prominent investigative journalist Ahmet Şık made a very powerful statement in his defense yesterday. Actually, he didn't call it his defense. He said, "I am accusing." He said, "They think that we are going to be afraid. They think that we are going to be silenced, but we are not." Who he means by they is the government, apparently. Aydın Engin, now the editor-in-chief, has said that this indictment is a farce.
Then there's the cartoonist with Cumhuriyet, Musa Kart, who's bringing some of his humor into the courtroom. I mean, he's been with the paper for the past 23 years. What did he say?
I was there at the court listening to his defense, actually, and there were a lot of times when the audience couldn't help laughing. It was as if we were watching a stand-up comedian, but we were actually in a court.
What did he say?
He said that he called a travel agency to book some hotel room in Bodrum, a touristic resort in the southwest of Turkey. And he said, "Instead, I have been sent to Silivri prison. I probably have made the wrong reservation," he said. And it was full of such instances. He's a very good cartoonist. He gave evidences of the cartoons that he had drawn within the years, critical of the terrorist organizations that he himself is also accused of aiding to. And he also denied all the accusations against him with humor and a touch of satire.
I chuckle, but this is really serious. I mean, there are representatives of human rights groups attending this trial. Why is it being seen as such a watershed moment?
It is a watershed moment for the press freedom in Turkey because Cumhuriyet is not an ordinary paper. This paper was founded just after modern Turkey was founded. It is the first newspaper in Turkey. It is founded on secularist principles. And those people who work in Cumhuriyet and those people who support Cumhuriyet say that it is actually the last remaining free press in Turkey. I have spoken to, for instance, the previous editor-in-chief, who's now on exile in Germany. He is also being tried in this case as well. And he said, if Cumhuriyet falls, there will be no more free press in Turkey.
What's a prediction of the kind of sentences these journalists could face?
They could face from 7.5 years up to 43 years. They are charged with serious allegations. Aiding a terrorist organization is a very serious thing in Turkey, as it is always in any other country. But the indictment is full of conflicting material. The lawyers of Cumhuriyet are saying that it is a shame that this case has come to this point with such an indictment, but they don't expect anything like a release on bail at the end of the trial.
With so many of its staffers in jail and on trial, has Cumhuriyet been able to continue publishing, and are they covering the trial of their own journalists?
Yes, they are covering the trial back to back every day. Just above the name of the paper on the very first page, they have been publishing their names and writing beneath them how many days they have been imprisoned. Today, it's been the 270th day, exactly 9 months since they were first jailed. And for months, Cumhuriyet has been publishing blank columns of the columnists who are currently jailed in order to prevent the readers from forgetting these names.
My BBC colleague, Selen Giret, in Istanbul. Selen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, Harvard's hidden figures of astronomy. You're with the world.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. I'm looking at an antique sepia photo of a woman in a hat with an ostrich plume, and it's hard to believe this Victorian lady is connected to modern astronomy. She has this serious expression on her face, the way people did when they sat for portraits in the late 19th century. Her name was Wilhelmina Fleming, and it's a name you should know. More than a century ago, she was one of the first women to work at the Harvard Observatory, about a mile from our studios. The World's Alex Newman has the story.
This is actually a plate of Halley's Comet.
And this is Lindsay Smith's roll.
It's one of our special plates. And then over here, that is a photo of the moon in 1903.
Smith's roll is the curator of astronomical photographs at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And her workspace looks like it's still 1903. Smith's roll works in the plate stacks. It's a dark, cramped room lined with metal cabinets filled with glass photographs of the stars from the last century.
Sometimes you need to use a little muscle.
As she gives me a tour on a sweltering summer day.
Great. Let's go downstairs so you can see what downstairs looks like. Just go this way. It's sort of like a labyrinth in here, just finding spaces to go.
She stops in front of each struggling air conditioning unit.
Does that sound like it's on?
Smith's roll is leading the effort to digitize almost 500,000 photographs of the sky that date back to 1885. But this isn't a story about some delicate glass plates. It's about the women who studied them claiming their place in history.
The first women, I think, started in the 1870s, and they were assistants for the men that worked here as astronomers and professors. They did a lot of calculations when the men would go out at night and work with the telescopes.
The women couldn't work at night. It was considered improper, but they could spend their days in this musty space studying the stars. One of these women was
Wilhelmina Fleming, who is very special.
Special doesn't even begin to describe this woman and what she accomplished. In the late 1870s, Fleming immigrated from Scotland to Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was pregnant at the time, but her new beginning here unraveled when her husband left her. That's when she met astronomer Edward Pickering. He was the director of what was then called the Harvard College Observatory. He hired her as his housekeeper, but it didn't take long for him to realize that she was bright and talented. He gave her a job in the observatory.
You can only imagine how that changed her life completely, because being a pregnant woman in the 1800s, all alone in a new city, let alone a new country, was probably really scary.
Pickering took a chance on Fleming, and it helped set a precedent for women working at the observatory.
Some people think Pickering only hired women because he could pay them less, which, yes, they were paid less, because back then women were all paid less for doing things. But he also really had an idea that if he hired women, they could prove that there was a place for women in not just astronomy, but in the sciences in general.
You could say these women are astronomy's equivalent of NASA's Hidden Figures. And like those African-American female computers, these women are finally getting more notice. Last year, best-selling author Dava Sobel published The Glass Universe about Harvard's female astronomers. Archivist Smith's roll has also discovered thousands of the women's notebooks deep in a Harvard library.
People didn't know they existed while they were in storage, and now that we know they exist, we can make them accessible to the public.
Head librarian Dana Boquin is working to scan and publish the notebooks.
If you search for Wilhelmina Fleming, you're not just going to find a mention of her in a publication where she wasn't the author of her work, you're going to find her work.
And they've just unveiled a display case dedicated to the life and work of Fleming, celebrating her as a trailblazer and a role model.
If you were a more technically inclined, nerdy little nerd bird girl, not having many people to look up to or examples to look at to see yourself in, it's hard.
Like Lindsay Smith's roll.
I was in foster care when I was younger. I went to 16 different schools before I graduated high school. It really took me a long time to start to find women who I felt were like me, who did important things, and I felt like I could actually do something important as well.
The women who walked these narrow halls would go on to make discoveries about the composition of stars and create a method to measure distance in space that is still used today.
If you come here early in the morning and all is quiet, it's like we're in the space that women worked at in a time when it wasn't common for women to work, and sometimes you get a little bit of chills.
The women who walk these halls now simply want to make sure those 80 women get their place in history. For The World, I'm Alex Newman, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Here's another historical note. 55 years ago, Russian composer Igor Stravinsky visited South Africa. He was 80 at the time, and he'd been invited to conduct a series of concerts there. Back in 1962, the apartheid regime in South Africa believed classical music was for whites only, but Stravinsky insisted on performing for a black audience as well. That concert took place in a township near Johannesburg. Prince Tete was there that day. He's 82 now, and he recently visited the hall where he watched Stravinsky perform in 62. This time, he went there with South African conductor Michael Dingaan, who asked Tete what he remembered of Stravinsky's historic performance.
I recall he struggled along, you know, to come and be in the center of the orchestra. When he was about to start conducting, as his hands went up like that, the audience, even before he did anything, the hall just went berserk, ululating, you know, your whistles, your screams. Yeah.
It must have been a sight for him as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I only hope he did not think that, hey, now, how am I going to entertain this rowdy crowd? But the people responded to the caliber of the concert. The style of music, it was just that. It blew us off.
May I play you something?
Oh. Thank you.
What if I told you that this recording was from the very concert you attended?
You see now. You see now.
And hence you danced the way you did now, moving so gracefully to these rhythmic impulses.
Oh, yes. You could hear a pin drop. Some of us regretted the fact that we did not have a good representation by our students, in spite of the fact that they were invited. They did not even have to pay. But it was those years where this kind of music, it's one of those things, you know, which didn't belong, as fate would have it, to our color.
And would you say part of it was the political environment of the time?
Undoubtedly, it was actually that. Because you will recall that getting to a music shop with instruments, you're standing next to those instruments, you know, was taboo.
Prince Tete was there in 1962 when Igor Stravinsky conducted a concert for a black audience in apartheid-era South Africa. Tete was speaking there with South African conductor Michael Dingaan as part of a BBC documentary on Stravinsky in South Africa.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. North Dakota exports a lot of food to Canada and Mexico. So when President Trump talks about ripping up NAFTA,
I would say there's a lot of anxiety right now.
Farmers in North Dakota support Trump, but they're nervous about what he'll do to trade.
Yeah, we're nervous, and absolutely have every right to be.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This week, we've been hearing from North Dakota as part of our 50 States project, hashtag 50 States. That's where we visit your communities across the country to hear how globalization is affecting you. No doubt you've heard President Trump talk about how we're losing badly in trade. It's true, the U.S. is a net importer of goods, but not all states are losing. Consider North Dakota. The state exports twice as much as it imports. The exports mostly crude oil and agricultural commodities. And as the world's Jason Margolis reports, many North Dakotans are concerned about Trump's talk on trade.
North Dakota regularly leads the nation in the production of crops like barley, canola, spring wheat, and honey. It's a big place, small population, 750,000. So farmers send a lot of their harvest overseas. Elected officials know full well exports are the state's lifeblood.
Hello, Jason, John Hoven.
How's everything down in D.C. today?
Working away.
Okay. That's U.S. Senator John Hoven, also a former governor of North Dakota. He's a Republican. Is he worried that his constituents could be hurt by amending trade deals or imposing tariffs? You bet he is.
Well, that's something I'm always concerned about. The United States, I mean, we are huge ag producers, and we need, you know, the world market. And ag is one area where the United States has a positive balance of trade.
President Trump talks a lot about renegotiating or walking away from NAFTA, the agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Hoven says the administration needs to be very careful there, but he has faith in the commerce and ag secretaries in Washington to protect agricultural interests. And Hoven thinks the president has backed off his talk to simply walk away from NAFTA.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think that may be part of his negotiating approach, if you will.
Still, not everyone is feeling quite so relaxed.
I would say there's a lot of anxiety right now.
Jeff Misling is CEO of the North Dakota Farm Bureau.
Agriculture is the bright shining star when it comes to trade. We've developed those relationships over the years. We have benefited tremendously from the NAFTA agreement. Our producers export a ton of goods to both Canada and Mexico. So anytime you mess with a multilateral agreement like that, and it took so much work to get to that point, any trade agreement, I think anybody would tell you, takes years to develop those relationships and get things on paper. So, yeah, we're nervous and absolutely have every right to be.
They may have a right to be nervous, but remember, North Dakotans helped put President Trump in office. North Dakota is Trump country, big time. He more than doubled Hillary Clinton's vote total here. Lucas Lang works on a family farm in Sterling, North Dakota.
Oh, the town itself, there's probably 50 in the township.
Despite the drama surrounding President Trump, Lang really likes the president, how he comes right out and says what he thinks.
With him, there's that always that little bit of unknown that will get the point across, that will appeal to those of us in the Midwest that aren't the quote-unquote elites on the coast.
And Lang likes the president's promises to rewrite the rules of trade to help people in this part of the country.
I'd call it maybe protectionist approach. I think we need to take care of our citizens first, get them good jobs, good manufacturing jobs, and then them guys that got them good manufacturing jobs can afford to buy our beef, our milk, our pork, you know.
That said, would you be willing to decrease exports to make that happen?
Yeah. I mean, I think, but it's a very complex approach with a lot of moving pieces. I mean, we'd have to get our economy moving. We'd have to, you know, cut regulations, get our manufacturers hiring good American labor, just, you know, kind of take care of our citizens first.
A patriotic stance, perhaps, but cutting exports would certainly hurt Lang's farm. Frayn Olson, an agricultural economist at North Dakota State University, is spending a lot of time on the farm these days.
Talking about trade and really what does this mean for them as farmers and their bottom line.
He talks about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. That was President Obama's signature trade agreement that would have covered 12 Asian Pacific nations and 40% of the world's economy. President Trump ripped it up hours into his presidency. Hillary Clinton claims she would have killed it too, by the way. Olson says the TPP would have been a big deal for North Dakota's farmers, standardizing the rules of trade.
It's not that we aren't already selling product into those regions. It's just when you sell into country A versus country B, they're going to have different rules. And so it's keeping track of all of this.
The 11 other nations in the TPP are now moving forward without the U.S., and that could hurt North Dakota's farmers. For example, wheat growers just to the north in Canada could soon have a leg up selling into Japan. Now, trade is complex, and it gets to be very political and very emotional very quickly. But those who are winning from global trade hope that President Trump doesn't throw out the good to try and improve the bad. For the World, Jason Margolis, Fargo, North Dakota.
And if you'd like to participate in our 50 States project, send us your story idea. You can go to PRI.org or just tweet us using the hashtag 50 States. I saw a story today in the New York Times about Yazidi women who had been abducted by ISIS in Iraq. Now that ISIS has been forced out of Mosul, these women are starting to go home, but they're deeply scarred. There are some women, though, who chose to join ISIS and marry fighters. And now that ISIS is losing territory in Iraq and Syria, some of these women are being captured. So what happens to them and their children? Borzu Daragahi of BuzzFeed News has met with some of these people in Syria. Tell us about one of these women you met, Borzu.
Well, there was one in particular who, I think she was quite charming because she spoke very good English. And her story was somewhat, you had to feel some sympathy for her. She had a husband and three kids. She was living in the city of Homs. A regime sniper killed her husband, and she, you know, was trying to make it as a single mom in Damascus. The war got too much for her there. And, you know, it was murky, her reasons for doing this. But she ended up, she said, going to Raqqa in an attempt to get out of Syria, and wound up getting trapped there. And in the time that she was there, she fell in love with a guy who was a Moroccan, a foreign fighter, who had come to join ISIS and had a kid with him as well. Mm. And so when the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces moved into Raqqa, she and her husband and their kids were caught. Her husband was taken to prison, and she was put in a refugee camp. They don't know what to do with her to some extent. Mm. And, you know, because she was an English teacher, she was very well able to tell her story. And it was, you know, full of contradictions, full of kind of holes. There was a few moments where it was kind of unexpectedly revealing. One thing she said that was rather interesting was, you know that ISIS are bad guys because they're losing, because they're losers. And if they were, you know, good guys, they would be winning now.
What did that suggest to you about her allegiance to the whole organization?
I mean, it's hard to say what's inside someone's heart. But my sense is that at some point in her life, at least, she believed in the cause. And she believed that this was, you know, the right way. And maybe she has second thoughts and so on. Keep in mind, these people are not accused of committing any crimes. They don't really have any blood on their hands or anything like that. They just seem to have joined or gotten engaged or married into a, you know, really horrible organization.
Right. I was going to ask you, I mean, so you've got this refugee camp with these kind of widows of ISIS fighters. How are these women being treated by their Kurdish captors?
From what we saw, they're being treated okay. You know, I mean, they're not really allowed to move around freely in the camp. It was awfully hot when we were there, and they were kind of stuck in this, you know, rather tough and muggy situation in terms of the temperature and overall climate. But they're being fed. There's no evidence that I saw that these women were being abused. The kids were playing.
What about the children? I mean, what kind of understanding do they have of what's happening to them and why?
This is a really tough, tricky question. You know, some of the older ones were confused and startled to be away from their fathers, wondering when the families will get back together. And some of the younger ones just really have no idea. You know, a lot of them were very, very small kids, you know, 1 year old, 2 years old. And it was, you know, quite clear that they basically saw this as just part of their life.
I mean, as you say, probably no blood on their hands, as far as we know. But what do they say? Like, what do they say about the atrocities committed by ISIS? Maybe by their own husbands.
Yeah, I mean, they all denied that their husbands were involved in any atrocities. In the case of the Tunisian woman, she insisted that her husband came to Syria. Her husbands, two of them, came to Syria only to fight against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. That they weren't involved in any crimes and so on. But, you know, they tended to sort of gloss over the things that ISIS has done, the atrocities and so on.
Right. So with that sense of denial, was there any regret or repentance from any of these women?
I did not hear any. I heard, you know, repentance and regret about coming to Syria and joining ISIS, but I did not hear anything. And I, you know, provided a lot of opportunities in interviewing these women over a few hours for them to express any kind of remorse or sympathy for ISIS's many, many victims.
So, Borzu, after this assignment to Syria, have you been able to form an impression of where ISIS goes from here? I mean, they're losing territory, as that Syrian widow told you. They're losing and they're losers. So how are they adapting?
Well, it's hard to tell, you know. Doesn't it seem like the number of foreign attacks has also gone down? I have a feeling that ISIS's stock is declining quickly. You know, it's been somewhat discredited. I think that the global effort to stigmatize and discredit this organization is kind of bearing fruit, and that, you know, it's going to fade in the same and maybe similar way that Al-Qaeda has faded as a threat. But I think that, sadly, none of the issues that in part gave rise to these extremist jihadi groups has been resolved. The kind of sense of grievance among Sunnis in the Middle East and beyond, the sense of, you know, hurt and injustice that created the sort of fertile ground for ISIS to take hold in Syria and Iraq. And more likely than not, you're going to get like a, you know, Al-Qaeda 2.0 or ISIS 2.0 emerging from the rubble of the region.
Borzu Dorogahi of BuzzFeed News, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
When the war broke out in Syria in 2011 and people began escaping to Turkey, no one thought they'd still be living there 6 years later. So there wasn't much of an effort to get Syrian kids into Turkish schools. But recently, Turkey has been pushing to change that. This year, they offered remedial courses in Turkish so Syrian kids can be ready for the fall. Thousands of children are benefiting from this, but there are still lots of kids who work instead of going to school. Kids like Lori Rashid, who's 17. She's been out of school for 5 years and says it's too late now for her to go back. Dalia Mortada has her story from Istanbul.
It's a steamy June day in Istanbul, and 17-year-old Lori Rashid lounges in the living room of her family's top-floor walk-up apartment. Her younger brother, John, is too shy to talk into the microphone and instead plays a game on his phone nearby. Usually, she'd be working at her job at a Turkish retailer as an Arabic-Turkish translator for Arab buyers. But Lori explains that she was recently let go from her job because there aren't enough customers. She says it's tough to hold a job as a Syrian in Turkey, that Turkish employers take what they need from Syrians and let them go. For a few reasons, Lori hasn't gone to school in nearly 5 years. Her family fled their home in Aleppo back in 2012, in the early days of the war in Syria. At the time, the crisis was considered to be temporary, and Syrian kids couldn't register in Turkish schools. Today, the Turkish government is pushing to get Syrian kids into school, but Lori still needs to work. Her dad doesn't earn enough money as a textile worker to keep up with Istanbul's high prices, and her mom has health issues that stop her from working full-time. So instead of going to school, Lori started working at the textile factory with her dad when she was 13. Lori says it's true that she hasn't been able to continue her formal education, but she's learned some very important lessons in what she calls the school of life. For one, she taught herself Turkish by watching shows on YouTube and learning the lyrics to Turkish songs. She's also been working on her English through a workbook her friend gave her.
The girl in the red dress is beautiful.
Her ease with Turkish got her out of the factory and into a better job as a translator. Lori hopes that with English, she'll have even more opportunities. Lori is clearly more mature than her age, but she still has moments when you remember that she's still 17. During a brief break in our interview, she stops, slightly pouts her lips, and poses for a selfie.
You're like Kendall Jenner.
Kendall Jenner.
She giggles that her friends compare her to Kendall Jenner. But just as quickly as she snapped her own photo, Lori transforms back into a teen who is wiser than her years. She says that school isn't as crucial for her as it is for her younger brother, John. At least she learned how to read and write before they left Syria, but John only got through the first grade. Now, he's a bashful 13-year-old who, like Lori, taught himself Turkish at home. He started school 3 months ago, and he'll enter fifth grade in the fall. Lori says she'll do whatever it takes to keep John in school. I hope he lives a better life than I have, she adds. Lori says she used to dream of getting back into the classroom. A dream, she says, that was stripped from her and too many other Syrian kids. Now, she thinks that goal is too trivial. Instead, she wants to restore the basic rights Syrian kids have lost, rights like going to school and dreaming of a stable future. For the world, Dalia Mortada, Istanbul.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We still don't know how President Trump's ban on transgender people in the military will actually work. The U.S. military doesn't seem to know either. No question, though, it's a setback for transgender rights here. But recognition of the transgender community is on the rise, and not just in the U.S. Even in a conservative country like Pakistan, trans activists are starting to press for their rights. But Pakistan also has a tradition of what's called third gender people, and they don't appreciate being called trans. Friend of the show Mobeen Azhar is a new BBC radio documentary exploring the transgender movement in Pakistan. So how prominent is the trans rights movement today in Pakistan, Mobeen?
The transgender rights movement, I'd say, is just starting out. So it's not visible on Pakistani TV or radio, really. And it's only operating in certain circles. As you might expect, those circles are mainly affluent, educated, and English speaking. So, for example, you will get trans rights activists speaking on university campuses. Having said that, general society, working class society, people who you'll see out on the streets in places like Karachi and Lahore are not really even aware of what transgender identity is. They are completely aware of this third gender, what we call the Khawaja Sera community. But the transgender identity is something that's really alien to the nation.
Yeah, so explain this third gender, the Khawaja Sera. I mean, it's not transgender. How are they viewed in
not,
Pakistan?
Yeah, so if you imagine, in Pakistan for hundreds of years, you've had a system where you have this third gender. Now, the third gender, the Khawaja Sera, that covers eunuchs, it covers intersex people, and it covers people who neither identify as male or female. So these people are not seen as transitioning gender in any way. They're seen as a distinct, separate category that are neither male or female. And culturally, they're believed to have special powers. So the idea is that they can bless you and they can even curse you at will. So in many ways, they're a community that are really revered. So for example, if someone is having a wedding, you will often invite a Khawaja Sera to come and perform and to bless the wedding. Similarly, if someone has a new baby in the family, you will invite a Khawaja Sera to the home to bless the child. So this is a community which is ingrained in every Pakistani town and city and village, and people know this community. As for transgender people, that's something that is seen as an alien thing in Pakistan.
So this revered third gender, the Khawaja Sera, how have they reacted to the trans rights movement?
I would say more than anything, they are feeling threatened. And, you know, you have to have some context for this, because the third gender community for hundreds of years in Pakistan have had systems in place. The most obvious system is what we call the Guru Chela system. So anyone who identifies as third gender invariably must pledge allegiance to a guru. So the guru is like a teacher, and the younger person is what is known as a chela, so an apprentice, so a teacher-apprentice relationship. Now, this relationship has a financial aspect. So the apprentice will promise to give a percentage of their earnings to the guru for the rest of their life. So if you can imagine now, you've got people increasingly who are saying, we are not part of this third gender community. We are actually transgender. And therefore, we will not be paying any of our earnings to a guru. And we do not prescribe to this kind of familial system. That is seen as a huge threat. And I met a bunch of Khawaja Seras, all of whom had gurus. And I asked them what they think of people in Pakistan who identify as transgender.
They are fake. If they don't have a guru, we don't recognize them. They are black sheep. It's wrong in Islam. If God has not made you a woman, how can you be a woman?
So one could see the Khawaja Sera in Pakistan as a unique centuries-old cultural thing for Pakistan. You could also see their attitude toward people who identify as transgender as just blatant hypocrisy. What is it?
You could, I mean, I think what we have to understand is, in many ways, this isn't about one system being more progressive and one system being more backward. There's a lot more nuance there, because in many ways, Pakistani society is actually more open-minded than Europe and America in the sense that you have this established system where people are free to identify as neither male or female, and people will not bat an eyelid. So I'm talking about even in the most conservative, the most religious areas, you will often see people who identify as third gender and they get on with their lives. You know, you'll see them walking on the street. No one will raise an eyebrow. It's seen as completely normal and it's seen as part of the culture. Now, the transgender identity is seen as something that is new and is threatening. And so, of course, you could say that there's an element of hypocrisy here. But ultimately, this is to do with how people want to define themselves. And this is about critical mass, because increasingly you have people who say they are not happy being identified as the third gender. They identify as either transgender men or transgender women. And Pakistani society is going to struggle to cope with that and struggle to accommodate that. And I think that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Mobeen Azhar telling us about his new BBC radio documentary exploring the transgender movement in Pakistan. Mobeen, always great to be with you. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you.
The South Korean pop star G-Dragon harkens back to the days of glam rock, but G-Dragon takes his musical cues from American hip-hop and R&B. He's in the midst of a world tour and has been doing dates here in the U.S. In Houston, a line of superfans, many of them girls with Korean roots, wrapped around the Toyota Center arena last week. And tonight in Brooklyn, G-Dragon takes a stage at the Barclays Arena and will probably pack them in like his Houston show. It's songs like this that drive the fans wild. You know, a love song where the guy did the girl wrong and he wants forgiveness. Here are the words in English that G-Dragon clues us in on. I can hear the crowd screaming now. The decibels could go higher tonight if G-Dragon covers any of the tunes he performs with his immensely popular boy band, Big Bang. I don't want to go too fast. There's nothing really left. Yeah. I think I need some time, but I can't get you off my mind. No, 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 no. If you're into G-Dragon, now's the time to see him. He's supposed to begin his compulsory military service in South Korea soon. Did anyone say Elvis Presley? And Korean pop acts come and go so fast, who knows when G-Dragon will be on the road again, either as a solo act or with Big Bang. That's where we leave you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can join us again tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.